But first, Jonathan Lethem. The New York Times once described him as a novelist who has spent a lifetime creating his own subversive pantheon. It's just been expanded to include Lethem's newest novel called Dissident Gardens. Jonathan Lethem talks with Steve Paulson about the book.
Jonathan, you've said that a lot of the writers you admire the most seem to be trying to be a different writer each time they write a new book, and that you would like to be that kind of writer. So I'm curious, has this novel, Dissident Gardens, taken you in a substantially new direction?
Yeah, I think it has in a whole bunch of different ways. First of all, you know, I find myself having difficulty even saying the words. It's a historical novel, right? And I'd never done that before, and I hadn't even really identified with it. But I never thought I liked reading historical novels. I like reading old fiction. I like reading about the 1950s by people who were alive and writing about it as it happened. But when I realized that I was setting out to do this, I was really at sea because I had to convince myself of something that as a reader I find very, very difficult to be convinced of, which is that the writer can have any meaningful authority over these periods that he's reconstructing in retrospect.
Well, I'm interested that you describe this as a historical novel, which obviously it is, as opposed to, say, a political novel, because it is so heavily immersed in the worlds of communism and of political activism.
Yeah, it's a depiction of characters who are defined by their commitment, their crazy passion for revolutionary change, for utopia. They want to live in a world other than the one that they've been given. And they do this in all sorts of mixed up ways in various parts of the 20th century and even on into the present, which for me actually was one of the keys to persuading myself of the project to begin with. I thought if I bring it to the present, I'll give evidence that I know what I feel is so true, that the story hasn't ended. It's not something sealed up in the past.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious about what you think of the political novel, which has kind of been, I don't know if discredited is the right word, but it's fallen on hard times. I mean, there was a time back in the 1930s when some of the great writers out there, people like John Steinbeck and John Dispassos, wanted to write the political novel. I mean, they didn't want to just be literary. They wanted a call to action. They wanted their readers to go out and change the world. Does that history have any resonance for you?
Well, I think if the political novel is defined by that standard you just offered, I haven't come close to meeting it because this book would be a very, very hard banner to march under. You know, like, let us now go and what? What would we do?
Become disillusioned, maybe?
I don't really recognize a clear definition that I can cozy up to in the idea of the political novel. Instead, this is a book about political people. Honestly, if you want to know what I think politically, you might be better off going to some other things I've written. A novel called Chronic City, for me, is an emblem of all kinds of political outrage I felt that's sort of sublimated into this crazy story. This book isn't really like that. This is about the human experience of wanting the world to be other than it is. And in a way, it could almost have been done as readily from the right. I could have written this book about people who believed that McCarthy was right and then wanted Barry Goldwater to be president and then are in the Tea Party. Because it was my insight that to be communist in the era that my characters were was actually a very American choice to make. It was very characteristic to be fitful and utopian and kind of place oneself at odds with history, that was a characteristic way of participating in our history.
Now, I've heard that one of your characters, one of your main characters, Rose Zimmer, was to some degree modeled on your own grandmother. Is that right?
More than to some degree. I mean, I think I started the book thinking I'm going to take everything I know about my grandmother and put it into this character and then work from there and start from there. Now, of course, once you start summoning up all the things a child can know about a very complicated, very dark, very intense, charismatic, but also very silent and enigmatic older woman, turns out there's not much. So I had a lot to invent as well. I had to surround my suspicions and my projections about my grandmother with all sorts of information from other places and from other people's lives, frankly, and also with just my own crazy wishfulness, my fantasies about, for instance, the book is very much about this woman's sex life in some ways, even when it's not one that's being realized. She has a series of fantasy boyfriends. It kind of begins with Karl Marx and goes to Abraham Lincoln and Fiorello LaGuardia, and she ends up in a fantasy relationship with Archie Bunker.
I have to ask you about Archie Bunker from All in the Family. The premise here is so absurd. It's hilarious. Rose is this aging Jewish communist at this point. And Archie Bunker, of course, was the quintessential bigot. And she falls in love with him in her imaginary world.
Yeah. Well, she's got this perverse streak in her that's very confusing for her, I think, that she's into authority. She kind of likes the beat cop, and she likes the neighborhood priest, and she likes mayors and presidents. There's something about the command and the assurance that she's excited about, and she wants to retrieve this for her own purposes. It's a very personal feeling for her. And then at the end of her life, when most of the justifications that she held so close, that had allowed her to maintain a kind of pure, hardline communist perspective, have been stripped away from her. History has denied her any solace, you know, basically as it did to true believers throughout the 20th century. It was a series of shocks and humiliations. What's left to her is her relationship to the neighborhood. She's become, despite herself, a resident of Queens. And she begins to see this tapestry of kind of ethnic styles that Archie Bunker exemplifies as having its own power and authority. And so she's really into his charisma and his willfulness and his the way you identify with him without wanting to. You know, even though he's saying absurd things, you lean forward. And so she herself is thinking, if I could only have Archie for a minute, if I could only lure him into my bed, I would change him. I'd make him think right.
The ultimate leftist fantasy, it sounds like.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, in fact, I'd love to get a taste of your story and of Rose. And maybe we can go back to the very beginning, the opening, when
sure.
It's sort of this classic moment of American communism here. Could you read that?
Okay, here goes. Quit screwing black cops or get booted from the Communist Party. There stood the ultimatum. The absurd sum total of the message conveyed to Rose Zimmer by the cabal gathered in her Sunnyside Gardens kitchen that evening, late fall 1955. Saul Eaglin, important communist, had rung her telephone. A committee wished to see her. No, they'd be happy, delighted, to come to her home. This evening, after their own conference just across the gardens, was 10 too late? This was a command, not a question. Yes, Saul knew how hard Rose labored, what her sleep was worth. He promised they wouldn't stay long. How did it happen? Easy. Routine, in fact. These things happened every day. You could get exiled from the cause for blowing your nose or blinking at suspicious intervals. Now, after so long, Rose's turn. She'd cracked the kitchen windows to hear their approach, brewed some coffee. Sounds of the gardens filtered in. Smokers, lovers, teenagers sulking in the communal lanes. Though winter's dark had clamped itself over the neighborhood hours ago, this early November night was uncannily balmy and inviting, last pulse of the earth's recollection of summer. Other kitchen windows were spilled to the lanes, voices mingled. Rose's plentiful enemies, fewer friends, others, so many others, simply tolerated. Yet, comrades all. According Rose their respect, even through their dislike. Respect to be robbed from her by the committee now entering her kitchen. There were five, including Eaglin. They'd overdressed, overcompensated with vests and jackets, now arraying themselves on her chairs like some Soviet oil painting, postured as if on some intellectual assignment. In pursuit of that chimera, the dialectical Hoosis, when really there was to be no dialectic here, only dictatorship and the taking of dictation. Still, Rose ought to be forgiving. These men were too young, apart from Eaglin, to have survived like she had the intellectual somersaults of the 30s, the onset of European fascism and of the Popular Front. They'd been children during the war. They were drones, men costumed in independent thought who'd become slaves of party groupspeak. None mattered in this room except the sole independent or thoughtful among them, a true and famous organizer, after all, a man of the factory floors. Saul Eaglin, and Rose Zimmer's former lover. Eaglin in his bow tie, hairline now gone behind his high cranium's arc like the winter's sun setting. Eaglin, the only among them man enough not to meet her eye, the only to grasp anything of the shame of it. Here was communist habit, communist ritual, the living room trial. the respectable lynch mob that availed themselves of your hospitality while dropping some grenade of party policy on your commitment, lifting a butter knife to slather a piece of toast and using it in passing to sever you from that to which you'd given your life. Yet that it was communist habit and ritual didn't mean these boys were good at it or comfortable. Rose was the veteran. She'd suffered one such trial 8 years ago. They sweated. She only felt exhaustion at their hemming and throat clearing.
Oh, that is so great. And you capture so much in just a couple of pages there.
Well, thanks.
And, you know, the true believers. And it's true believers who, well, I mean, you go back to that era in American history, and then you pick up the political scene with the hippies of the 60s and 70s, and you take it all the way up to the Occupy Wall Street movement. Why did you want to sort of trace that arc?
It connects, for one thing, to the first question you asked and my reply, that the historical novel seems to me very hard to trust. You know, like, how can we really believe that the past is like this? Well, one way of testing it, or any way of being honest about this uncertainty that I felt, is to bring it right to the present so as to say, look, it connects, but also the past is a construction of the present. We have no way back there. We can only think about it on the terms of present experience and with present language, and it's probably being colonized at every corner by our current framework and our current thinking.
Jonathan Lethem is the author of The Fortress of Solitude, Chronic City, and his newest novel, Dissident Gardens. He spoke with Steve Paulson. And you can find the extended version of Steve's conversation with Lethem on our website, ttbook.org. Do you have a favorite novelist? Someone you think deserves greater recognition? Add to our crowdsourced list of great unsung novelists on Facebook or Twitter, or on our website,